Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, an effort to honor a Black Civil War veteran shines a light on the larger story of Jacksonville's Cosmo community. Later in the program, new research confirms the existence of an Alzheimer's gene and suggests that the disease takes a financial toll years before a diagnosis. But first, an unmarked grave in an overgrown cemetery holds the story of a Civil War corporal, as well as the history of an often forgotten historic Black community. To discuss that, we're joined by Dr. Irvin DePedro Cohen, Executive Director of LISC Jacksonville. Welcome.
Good morning.
Nice to have you back.
Thank you.
Also joined by Adonica Toller, local historian and director of the Eartha M. M. White Museum. Welcome back, Adonica.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
And we're also joined by Dr. Raymond Oldakowski, professor of geography at Jacksonville University. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Dr. Cohen, let's start with this neighborhood and kind of how LISC Jacksonville got involved in this particular effort on this gravesite.
Well, I think we came along as part of a larger initiative that we have called Operation Final Hours. And it's our effort to provide headstones for loved ones in unmarked graves throughout Northeast Florida.
Huh.
And so I think we were probably the last entry into the party, but nonetheless, we are glad to be there.
So that's actually kind of a tall order in Jacksonville. There are a lot of grave sites that have been, you know, neglected over the years, or whoever owned them has moved on and they're not well tended sometimes.
Well, for us, it was really about our effort to, in the communities that we work in, to provide access to VA programs for those residents that lived in those neighborhoods who were part of our military. And so that's how Operation Final Hours came about. And so when we heard about this effort with JU and UNF, it just kind of made sense for us to be involved in the process.
And I want to talk about that. But for people who aren't familiar with LISC Jacksonville, you've been on before, but just give us a brief explainer of the work that you do.
So LISC is an acronym for Local Initiative Support Corporation. And we are a financial and social intermediary. And what that means is we bring resources and programmatic offerings to some of our most under-resourced communities throughout our city.
Okay.
And we've been doing it now for the last 25 years.
Adonica Toller, this grave site has been, you know, getting a lot of attention because of this effort to put a new marker on the site. But it has also helped bring attention to an area of Arlington that is not widely known sometimes for the historic Black communities really that were there. What was there prior to the modern day of, you know, kind of the university and then the surrounding neighborhoods, suburbans?
So actually that area, people would be surprised to know, was owned by African Americans or former enslaved. And a big part of what is JU's property, one of the daughters of Anna Kingsley, that actually was her property. So that whole area, and even further around, Anna Kingsley herself had property. And so rolling around to Cosmo that we're talking about, some of the descendants of Anna Kingsley are residents of the Cosmo area, as well as those coming from the St. George Sea Islands in South Carolina, coming to settle in that area.
And remind us, Anna Kingsley, not everybody will know her name.
So Anna Jai Kingsley was the wife of Kingsley Plantation, Zephaniah Kingsley, I can think of it. Zephaniah Kingsley, he actually bought her as a slave in Senegal. He later married her, and she actually was his primary wife, and married her in an era where it was totally illegal to do that, but he did it, and she actually ran the plantation, and at least three or four of the kids had plantations around the state of Florida. When the Spanish lost control of Florida and the English were going to take over, Kingsleys went to what is now Dominican Republic and settled there, and there are descendants there today.
And there is not a lot left of that historic neighborhood. Explain to us what happened. I mean, it's, I think, all too common a story, particularly when we're talking about those freed slaves, or people who were living in those communities after the Civil War.
Well, it happens what we would call gentrification or urban removal. So areas that slither of land now is about between two subdivisions. And if you're familiar, it's in the Fort Caroline area. If you're familiar, and the post office that's there, that's the easiest marker for me. It's like kind of behind that, in that smaller area.
And these properties kind of ran back from the river, or the part of the river that's known as Mill Cove, right?
Yes.
And they were very long, narrow passages of property.
Great way of income, taking care of your family, all of those things. But slowly and surely, property thing being grown and developing, because you imagine it is out in the country, in the deep, not in the city. And so they were living in and enjoying the water. And especially those who came from South Carolina and Georgia, they are used to the water. So that living on the water was an easier way of life. And some of them actually traveled by the water, by the banks, to get to the area. So,
but that land became very valuable.
As time moved on. And so they have been fighting, and they still continue to fight to preserve their legacy, preserve their... There's only a few buildings left, but definitely a conversation that you should have later with the Levon White, who's the president of the Cosmo Historic Preservation Group. Definitely someone to, you know, talk with and get even more in-depth information, because they do have records of families where they were located. And I forgot the city council member that helped with the park that's there. I can't remember the name, but there's a city council member that actually helped them do a Freedom Park. Forgive me for not remembering your name right now. But so there is effort by the city and the state to preserve these historic places.
Dr. Raymond Oldakowski, I want to bring you into this conversation. You helped lead this effort to replace a headstone for the grave of Civil War veteran Corporal William Johnson. He was a Black Civil War veteran. Why was this effort undertaken, and why was JU involved?
I was approached by Dr. Craig Bettinger, who's a professor of history here at JU, and he had gotten in touch with Christopher Smith, who's a program, the community development program officer at LISC, and had found out about the Operation Final Honors. And I guess the year before I got here in 1989, they had a small recognition when they initially found the gravestone of Corporal Johnson, and the gravestone was propped up in that cemetery area, but then it was stolen soon after that, and nothing had really happened for the next 30 years. Dr. Bettinger had told me that they'd made some attempts to get in touch with the Veterans Administration to get a replacement headstone, but at that time they were told that only direct descendants of Corporal Johnson could apply for a headstone. And then I sort of worked together. I decided that we should contact Congressman Bean's office. He's a alumni of JU. Spoke to Christopher. He had gotten in touch with the UNF Digital Humanities Institute.
Christopher from LISC.
Christopher Smith from LISC, yes. And he had gotten in touch with the UNF Digital Humanities Institute. They got some pension records for Corporal Johnson. We worked together with the Florida Department of Veterans Affairs and got a VA staffer, Brandon Washington, who helped shepherd the application through. And then I guess it was March of this year that LISC received the replacement headstone.
And so this, for people who aren't maybe able to visualize where this cemetery is relative to the JU property, explain to us where it is and kind of the condition that it's in.
Sure. Actually, we looked at, we should give a shout out to the property appraiser's office as well. They helped us with trying to figure out who actually owns the property. It is a small lot, probably about 20 yards by 40 yards, located right off of University Boulevard, between the road and a warehouse that we have here on the campus. It's just a typical piece of North Florida on, you know, undeveloped land, unlandscaped land. It's just sort of the natural setting there. And I guess in when they initially discovered the first headstone back in 1989, they put a small kind of passive fence, just a few wood posts with a chain along it and a gate. And our physical maintenance plant persons had told us that they had been given instructions a long time ago to passively maintain the area, that there would be no mowing, you know, no chemicals or fertilizers or that sort of thing, because it was a cemetery.
And so given that it's kind of in that rough Florida state, where are you going to put the headstone?
Well, what we are doing, again, LISC and JU have gotten together with Haskell. They have provided some preliminary work on designing a little a sacred space that we could define with a, you know, a more formal fence, a walkway that would make it possible for people to go in and out of the area, a gazebo, some benches, that sort of thing, so that it's something that we would welcome folks to be able to look at Corporal Johnson's headstone and sort of other placards that would honor the other folks that are buried there.
And you mentioned Haskell. That's the Haskell Company. They're a local engineering engineering company here. Why? How did they get involved?
I believe LISC had contacted them in trying to, you know, move us to the next step.
I gotcha. And Dr. Right. Cohen, you're nodding.
Yes, that's exactly how they got involved in the process. We wanted to make sure that the design of the area where Corporal Johnson is buried was reflective of something we wanted our community to be proud of. And so we reached out to a few people, and Haskell has stepped up and said they will be more than happy to help us design an area that will be reflective of that.
And Adonica, this headstone, as Dr. Oldkowski alluded to, had been discovered back in 1989. And then the campus newspaper wrote a story about it, profiling the corporal and what we knew of him, what they knew of him at that time. And soon thereafter, the headstone went missing. That's an all too common, I think, circumstance when you have, you know, relics of the past, or perhaps even more recently. I think we can remember when a memorial in St. Johns County went missing soon after its dedication, commemorating a lynching that occurred there.
Yeah, that's very interesting that someone would take it, but you're right. And when you think about what we think about cemeteries, they're sacred, and especially for someone like Corporal Johnson, who gave his life to for freedom, what we talk about in the United States, that someone would take his marker and have no problem taking it. And I'm not sure why they would have done that. I mean, maybe they didn't want it, his memory, to be reflective. And that's what's really important about cemeteries, especially African-American cemeteries. There's history in those places. And as I looked into Corporal William Johnson's story a little bit, he very well may have known Lafayette White, who married Clara White, who is Eartha White's parents, or her parents. So it's very possible that there's a connection between those, and they're a very important part of American history in preserving freedom that we so enjoy and that we so long to have here in this country.
And that connection, you mentioned Clara White. She's obviously a, you know, well-known name for the Clara White Mission, which her daughter named after her. But she was an instrumental figure in helping people who had recently left slavery.
Correct.
To stay fed, really, and to
Correct.
Stay mm-hmm. housed. And her relationship with Lafayette White was that she later married
him. She later married him. Clara was a nurse and a cook in the Civil War, and she served the 33rd and the 34th, which is where Lafayette and Johnson were respectively. And after the war, she was a big figure in making sure veterans were settled, that they had a place to be. So I'm wondering, did she know him? Did she help settle him there? Or just did she keep in touch with him after the war? Did they go visit? So now my imagination is running wild, which also gives you, it gives you context and it gives you a like, oh, these were real people and not just some figure we're learning about. It's not just a marker. It represents a life and a community.
So he was Corporal Johnson was in the 33rd Infantry and
Lafayette was in the 34th.
Lafayette was
and they moved together. They moved together when they went to battle.
Gotcha. Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the history of the Cosmo neighborhood and efforts to restore a nearby African-American cemetery. You can join our conversation live on air by giving us a call at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or reach out on social media. We have a call. Good morning, Stanley. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning to Ann and my good friend, Pedro. Yes, great job. And to the rest of the guests, y'all doing a fantastic job. But when we talk about that area, especially over on this part of the United States, those are Gullah Geechee people. We've been here over 15,000 years. But we used to own all this property, especially when we talk about Jacksonville for a period of time. And Jacksonville only been around about 201 years. But African Americans have participated in the wars for over 200 years. And there's plenty, should be plenty marked. Now, I'm sorry, still moaning. I'm sorry, but there's plenty opportunity by the African American community that they need to put the history out there, because we have a vast history in Jacksonville. I'm talking about African American veterans. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Stanley. Appreciate it. Dr. You know, Cohen.
Yeah,
go ahead.
It's yes. Ironic because the in preparing for this, what I found is that the 2021 statewide study conducted by the Task Force on Abandoned African American Cemeteries suggested that 30-40% of the cemeteries that were primarily housed African American deceased were unmarked. And so that really led us to really start this body of work. And then I think secondly, and just as important, is this notion of history. You know, it's important to tell history in an unadulterated, you know, unsanitized way. It may not be nice. It may not be pleasant, but it's still nonetheless our history. And that's why it's important for us to tell the story in a way that sometimes, you know, quite frankly, will make some people feel uncomfortable.
Sure. Yeah. It's an uncomfortable history. Dr. Cohen, you also do something at LISC that's called not placemaking, but creative placekeeping.
Right.
Explain to us what that is and how this this area ties into that.
For us, creative placekeeping recognizes the history of the place that we're going into. You know, I'm not necessarily a big fan of this idea of creative placemaking because it assumes that you're going in to make something that wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And so what we've done is we've approached this work recognizing the history and all of the things that were in existence before we mm-hmm. got there. We are just there to really, I always say put some earrings on the situation and maybe put some makeup on the situation. But we are not there to disrupt the history of what's already happened in those communities. And so we've approached our work as part of our larger strategic plan is creative placekeeping as very essential. And what this body of work recognizes, what this area had a history. We are there to find out what that history is and then accentuate what's already on the ground.
Can you talk about some other communities where LISC has been doing that kind of work and what we can see from it?
Sure. I mean, if you go into any of the LISC supported neighborhoods north of our city, creative placekeeping is what we really lean into. The area along the Rebar River, that's creative placekeeping. Again, and this work of finding Corporal Johnson's gravesite really allows us to lean into our work around Ayers property. As we go into neighborhoods and we find out there are veterans that are living in these communities, and their families don't necessarily have access or know that they have access to VA programs, it allows us to do that work. And we do it in a way that recognizes the almost sanctity of what's happening on the ground and recognizing the indigenous people to those communities and how do we support them with the work that we're doing. Our home repair, our heirs property work, Project Boots, all of those things recognizes that there are communities that are already intact, and how do we support people on the ground?
Dr. Oldakowski, I want to ask, since there was a prior headstone that was, you know, at this grave site that was removed or stolen, what is the plan to make sure that that doesn't happen in this case and that it's protected?
Yeah, that's a good question. Number one, when we had the ceremony a few weeks ago or last week, we brought the headstone to a central community area, River House on JU's campus to display it. We did not put it in the cemetery area, but it is solid granite. It is very heavy and would obviously be anchored into the ground. And I would suspect we have not made any sorts of plans yet with our security office here at JU, but the area would be patrolled and lit and that sort of thing as well. But as you mentioned, it's something to be concerned about because, like we said, it's right off of University Boulevard.
It seems that there is increased awareness by educational institutions, higher education, to reckon with, you know, its history and its past. You know, at my own alma mater at the University of Wisconsin, I know they've been really doing a lot more in terms of the indigenous people that once lived there and recognizing that. Is there any sense that JU, larger than just this cemetery, is looking at the history of the property and you know, where it came from, who it belonged to, along the river there in that stretch that we're discussing?
Yes, our DEI office has already put out statements about the land ownership of the area before the university came here. There are Native American burial grounds that are on the campus areas mm-hmm. as well. The Delius House is part of JU's infrastructure, so it's part of our campus history as well. And we do try to get the students involved in all of these activities so that they're aware of the fact that this land has not been Jacksonville University. Actually, just for the last 90 years is how long we've been here. And there's a long history before it.
Right. And you mentioned your DEI office. We should point out JU is a private institution. That's why it's allowed to have a DEI office while state schools no longer are. But that sort of speaks to what Dr. Cohen was saying in terms of, you know, learning about this history at Anoka and recognizing even painful parts of it.
Correct. And the painful brings out the good as well. And so, but it's very important that we know our history. It's very important to just know where we are and then deal with whatever the consequences are. And we've all come through challenging situations in our life. We have it now. And our American history is that it's very complicated. It's not one-sided. It's very shaded. So those slavery, yes, slavery was a terrible institution, but some powerful people came out of that. And it made a change when you talk about Harriet Tubman, when you talk about Clara White, and the impact they had coming out of those, that institution, they still impacted and they blessed the community. So it's important that we know what the history is, even if it's painful, so that we can know how strong we are and make sure we don't make the same mistakes again.
Dr. Oldakowski, it seemed like there was an interesting parallel that you all drew between the work that JU and its partners in this case formed to try to get this new headstone and what had happened initially when 130 years ago there was kind of a group effort to get a headstone for Corporal Johnson. Can you tell us about that parallel?
I wish I could. That is more Dr. Bettinger's area of expertise. So as a matter of fact, that's what he spoke about when he gave a few remarks at the ceremony last time, how it was a community effort. I guess Corporal Johnson and his wife both needed assistance in filling out the paperwork and being able to actually get his veterans benefits and then to obtain the headstone back in the 1800s.
Dr. Cohen, why is it important that this be a group effort in this case?
Well, I think it's because it's bigger than one organization. And I think that, you know, that's how we truly stand in as a community and you know, do this thing collectively. I don't think this work is reflective of one organization. And I think this is a perfect example of how we move humanity forward when we all join together and don't place this burden on one entity to get done. And so I'm very happy to have, you know, my organization work with JU. I'm happy to have my organization work with UNF to advance this cause forward.
And how important is it to have somebody like Representative having Aaron Bean participate in this as a lawmaker? Do you think that that kind of furthers the discussion with a legislature that has been, you know, hot and cold when it comes to issues of teaching certainly Black history in this state?
Well, I think it says that the work that we're doing is not necessarily political. And I think it shows that we have the capacity to see beyond any political differences to advance a larger cause forward. And so it also suggests to me that, you know, not only were there, you know, white soldiers during the Civil War, but there were Black soldiers as well. And so Corporal Johnson's is a perfect example of his story coming to light, and Congressman Bean's support of us helping to get the gravestone says that the issue is bigger than politics, and there are still those things that in our society we can have civil discussions around. It's still those things in our society that we can all collectively wrap our arms around to advance the cause for. And I'm very, very, very happy that Representative Bean leaned in to help us get this done.
Well, I'd like to thank all of you for being here, Dr. Raymond Oldakowski, Dr. Pedro Cohen, Adonica Toller. A good conversation. I appreciate all of your insights.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be back in just a minute with our own Dr. Joe Servin. We're going to be talking about some new discoveries on the Alzheimer's front. Welcome back. I'm joined now by our own Dr. Joe Servin of the Saturday WJCT program, What's Health Got to Do With It? And he visits us every month for a house call, both to talk about medical news and to take your questions. You can call us at 904-549-2937. You can email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you don't want us to use your name on the radio, we're certainly welcome to do that. I want to talk, Alzheimer's is a devastating disease, and there's some really interesting news on that front. But I want to start with a topic that I know is of interest to a lot of parents out there, and that is the early age that girls are reaching puberty. There was just a study about this.
Yeah, that's right, Ann. There was a study just published in the Journal of American Medical Association where they looked at two factors. 70,000 individuals, so it's a huge study, that were born between 1950 to 2005, and they tracked the age of their first menstrual period, and then also the timing to when that menstrual cycle became regular. What they found is that over the decades, the timing to the first menstrual cycle has come down to roughly 11 years. Now, it's not a huge difference. It's at 12.5 or something along those lines was the average age when they tracked it back in 1960. But this is like one of the first few huge studies to show that this has now lowered to age 11. And that's the average. That means that there are ages even below age 11 that you may find that they are seeing the first menstrual cycle and a regular menstrual cycle. And that's an indicator of a whole host of things. In fact, the company editorial pointed out that there's a lot of things that this could show us.
So I think anecdotally, as parents, we hear this from our friends, you know, parents of other kids. It does happen seemingly much, much younger. Parents are very often not prepared for it. This study found kids as young as 9, you know, second graders.
It's amazing. The answer is yes. So when people say that can't happen, oh, it very much is. And that's the big question is, like, you know, why? The assumption, and that doesn't mean they proved it, their guess is that this is more related to nutrition, weight, being overweight, which then opens up the door to more chronic diseases and things of that sort.
And there's some correlation between body mass and almost like kind of the ability to make children is somehow conditioned or predicated on a certain amount of weight.
Exactly. If you are overweight, sometimes then your body can produce hormones that can begin to almost mimic or trigger sex hormones. And as a result, this is a sign of, again, just an overweight population, too high of a BMI, that's body mass index, which is an indicator of obesity and overweight. And that's one element. And that'll probably account for a big chunk of it. Then the rest of it is the question, is this environment, toxins, we can go from plastics, chemicals, you name it. And are they also kind of creating a little bit of harry-carry here? But to parents out there, if they are the parents of a little girl or something along those lines, and they find that their menstrual cycle is occurring, you know, that's important to get it checked out earlier than they thought. But know this, this is not an uncommon finding. And now we're seeing the first verifiable numbers telling us that that exactly is what's going on.
And yet early menses has a lot of potential health conditions that go with it. And some of them are not that great. And increased risk of cardiovascular disease, increased risk of cancer or early death, and those uneven periods that you said before they become regular, a longer period of that can sometimes be associated with infertility.
Yeah, so this is that's the other fascinating part of this. Is the fact that this could be a marker of just a population health overall, because exactly what you just said is that the younger the age that someone achieves menstrual cycle, that means that is more correlated to those chronic diseases, the ones that you just mentioned. Curiously, they find that the older you are to reach menstrual cycle, because there are some countries that have that, that's more representative of undernutrition and higher correlation to infectious diseases.
Oh, okay.
And so this opens up this interesting door that is this, should this be one of those report card things that we should be looking at? I mean, it made news because it's the first study of its kind for this large number, but maybe this is something that should be tracked all the time.
Another thing that they flagged in this study was just the early sexualization,
yes,
of kids. And that's a problem that comes with an early puberty, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, we talk so much about all the issues that occur in preteens. And now if there's this extra added element of a younger age of menstrual cycle, that does open up that whole doorway of concern, earlier sex education. I mean, these are potential, sadly, in some of these young girls, targets for those that could take advantage of this. And that's something that we kind of have to be mindful about with this.
Sure. Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the latest medical headlines with our in-house doctor, Dr. Joe Servin, of What's Health Got to Do With It? And he's also taking your calls or your questions. You can reach us at 904-549-2937. You can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. So I want to move on now. Let's talk about Alzheimer's, because there's a couple of really big headlines on this front. The first is the discovery of an Alzheimer's gene.
Yeah, so this gene has been known for a while. What these folks that in this newest study published in the journal Nature Medicine, they had 500 patients, and they found that people who had inherited two copies of a very specific gene called APOE4 had this very, well, they almost all had, they all ended up with the disease. If you had both copies of this gene. What that means is that for a big chunk of patients, that goes from not just being a risk factor, which is how it's classified now, but that they argue could be a sign of a cause, a genetic cause. That would account for about 15 to 20% roughly of all Alzheimer's patients. So it's not everybody, but it does open up the door if it's a gene. And you know how easy it is to get a genetic test.
Yeah.
Should you and would you?
Well, let me ask. So the people who have both of these genes, you say, compose about 15 to 20% of the overall Alzheimer's population. But people with both genes are pretty much going to get Alzheimer's?
Here was the only problem with the study is that that element varies per your ethnicity and race. Mm. We know that in African Americans, both copies of the studies gives you a huge risk. And in this study, they found that all of those patients did. But not in other groups because it varies from ethnicity to ethnicity. It may markedly increase your risk, but it does not necessarily mean that it will occur. But in the study, they found everyone who had both copies did have it.
So is this gene the kind of thing that a 23andMe, you know, home genetic testing type thing can pick up?
I knew you were going to ask that because I know people give that away as a holiday gift. And I'm always like stunned by that. But nonetheless, yes, this is the type of thing. APOE4 is not a difficult gene to detect. The thing is, though, there have been all these great new therapies that are out there for Alzheimer's treatment, but they're not approved for both copies of the gene. They're approved for the disease, but they specifically state for this group of patients, these expensive infusion treatments, that you may not be the right candidates because they're the ones most likely to get the side effects, which are pretty serious from these agents. So this really brings on a lot of nuance as to what to do because we don't have the treatments for this group.
So you could have that knowledge that you are likely to develop Alzheimer's but not have a ton of options at this point?
That is exactly the case. And that is like, that's the conundrum. Like, should you test for something, you'll have this knowledge with the strong sense that this is going to be your future. But again, what do you do about it? And that's going to, in one level, until we get those treatments, it may not be the right moment because I can imagine just the psychological consequences of that.
Be vast. But that does sort of dovetail with our other medical headline when it comes to Alzheimer's, which is they've found now that evidence of financial problems manifesting themselves years before a diagnosis, people falling behind on their mortgage payments, people being in arrears with their credit cards, that I think they combined Equifax data and health data from Medicaid and found that people who were ultimately diagnosed with Alzheimer's had this, you know, period of financial disruption and decline.
I think this is fascinating when you combine medical data with something like credit card bureau. It's a reminder that Alzheimer's is a long, long condition, decade, more than a decade. And so before you have those early symptoms, you may have these kind of very subtle changes. And I think this is fascinating because it tracks with what I see as a practicing physician, that like in arrears, as you ask questions, when did this first start happening? Well, they started missing bills, or they, you know, a risky investment that you shouldn't go down the road. So what this study showed is that indeed that is something that can occur. And it makes sense because in some direction, it's like, you know, when you're making these investments, you're really kind of working on executive function, you know, initiative and things of that sort. And sometimes you lose that inhibition, that thing that kind of pulls you back to put all the money on something. And it's just a reminder that how long this occurs before you show up to a doctor saying that something's not right.
And so I think they in keeping with what you're saying, they also found some evidence that, you know, people with this early indicator might be more subject to fraud or manipulation or exploitation.
And that completely makes sense. And it's another reminder of how we just have to be so vigilant for these unusual social situations that, to be honest with you, I never really thought so much about the finances of the individuals when they came and saw me, other than we worried about the safety. Did they turn off the stove? But the financial piece, that's even bigger in this regard, because that gets to, you know, how people want to control and keep their independence as long as you want.
I mean, I guess that early diagnosis, if nothing else, could help you perhaps make some of those decisions.
Exactly.
I want to move on to a topic that I think is really interesting. Scientists believe they have identified a gene that makes animals better fathers and maybe even less promiscuous. What is this about?
Oh, my goodness. Let me give the disclaimer of first of all, it is in mice, so we don't know how it applies in people, but it is curious. So they found that the adrenal gland of a very specific type of mouse that is known to be very monogamous and nurturing can they produce a hormone that is not seen in their non-monogamous kin, if you will. And this is called 20-alpha hydroxyprogesterone. And it seems to be, when they inject it into their non-monogamous kin, makes them more nurturing and kind and monogamous as a group. Now, that's a fascinating one because no one knew about this particular area, but it opens up the door. What does that mean in humans when we know that it exists?
I'm very interested to know. I want to just quickly, if we can, get a call from Brad. Brad, just briefly, if you can go ahead.
As you guys were talking before, we have dates for women to get breast exams. We have dates for men to get prostate exams. When should we assess the mental acuity of a loved one so we can better help them, to keep them from those monetary issues that seem to happen every time, and just to give them a better quality of life, understanding what they're going through?
Good question, Brad.
That is a fantastic question. You know, we don't have a particular date or time because there's so much variability amongst people. So there's no screening, if you will, to be honest with you, officials or public health people have come out with to say, hey, you know, we should get this checked out. Oftentimes that issue that you're bringing up only comes in the context of someone who's presenting with a new symptom. Like if I have a relative or a friend that they're like, you know, something just doesn't seem right, that's when people get checked out. We still don't have a good screening time for, in essence, a brain health mindset. And that's something that we do have to figure out. Your point is right on target. We don't do that. The only group of people that we do things like that for are pilots, because of how important they are to public safety.
Well, Dr. Joe, thank you so much for being here. We love talking all the medical news with you once a month. Thanks for being here.
And it's always a pleasure. Can't wait to next month.
Same here. And up next, an easy way to reduce your carbon footprint one bite at a time.
Stephen Sondheim's musical, Merrily We Roll Along, opened in 1981, it flopped. But the new Broadway revival is a hit with 7 Tony nominations. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the director, Maria Friedman, who was a close friend of Sondheim's, and Jonathan Groff, who won a Tony for his role as King George III in Hamilton. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Wildfires on the island of Maui last year destroyed the homes of 4,000 families. So what if short-term vacation rentals were converted into long-term housing?
The overwhelming number of them, about 90% of them, are owned by people who don't live in Hawaii. So this is what's underpinned, you know, the activists.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
Solitude is not the same as loneliness. Loneliness can damage your health, but solitude, on the other hand, can actually boost your well-being.
We enjoy each other's company, and social interaction can bring us so much joy. But we also need time for solitude to recover, to switch off. Don't see it as something is wrong.
The Power of Solitude on the next On Point.
Today at 11, here on WJCT News 89.9.
The jury has had its say. Now you get to have yours. With the guilty verdicts now in, does the Manhattan case prove no one is above the law or add weight to concerns that the justice system is being used to go after a political opponent? Rosemary in Virginia has made up her mind.
So the unanimous verdict gives me confidence. And frankly, I cannot understand why anyone would vote for a convicted criminal.
That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. It's healthy, it's environmentally sound, and it takes some effort. But if you've ever wanted to try eating vegan, consider June your gateway drug. To talk about it, I'm joined by Yuri Mitskevich, Challenge Coordinator for the Vegan Chef Challenge. And he's going to tell us a little bit about how to become more involved. Welcome, Yuri.
Good morning, Anne.
So you yourself are vegan. Tell us a little bit about how you started eating vegan and whether it was tough.
Yes, I am. Around 15 years or so, maybe a little over, that I've eaten solely vegan. As far as the switching, I mean, how tough it was initially, it's a learning curve. That's mm-hmm. for sure. There are different, like, to switch out the foods that we're used to, you know, the meat, the dairy, and eggs. And
it's always the cheese that you hear people.
That's right.
Like, that's
right.
Tough, really tough transition, right?
Yeah. And there's been a lot of, like, dairy alternatives for years with the milks and everything, but the cheeses are sort of coming on strongest most recently. So in the beginning, when you're first trying it out, like, learning those options to try out in the supermarket where you see the substitute, you know, vegan meats, vegan chicken, beef, all that.
I mean, it must have gotten a lot easier to be vegan now than 15 years ago, even.
Exactly. Yeah. And back then, like, these products that I'm mentioning were in the kind of initial phase. You know, there's been things like veggie burgers for a century almost, with, like, the Seventh-day Adventist vegetarian, you know, focus and everything. They've been around quite a while, but they've been picking up quite a lot, like, the last decade especially.
So what is the Vegan Chef Challenge? It's happening in the month of June. You're helping to put it together, but what all does it involve?
Yeah, so it's we just kicked it off on Saturday. So it runs from the 1st of the to the 30th this month. So it's as part of, like, Vegan Outreach, the nonprofit that is sponsoring it, that I'm with. It's one of our projects that we do, like, as a nonprofit. Our aim is to end violence towards animals. It also has, like, the, you know, the benefits, as you mentioned at the beginning, like the environmental and the health, you know, the really strong health benefits that are with it. So with all of these things in mind, it's kind of something that we're doing across the country. We had these in 30 cities last year. So it's definitely, you know, a popular campaign that we do here in Jacksonville. This time we have a dozen restaurants that are in the challenge. So the website, you know, that we have up is where you can see, you know, what locations you can go to try eating vegan. They, on our website, you can see, you know, where to find them, their website, and also the special menu that they've created, which is how the event works. So the chefs that we're working with at these restaurants are doing new vegan dishes that they don't have, and they haven't been doing until now. So it's a great opportunity for folks that are interested to try eating vegan to, like, go out and try something special this month.
And these are not necessarily vegan restaurants. They're restaurants that are going to incorporate at least some choices that are vegan.
Right, right. The majority of them, I believe 9 out of the 12 are not vegan establishments. They're not vegan businesses. So it is something a lot of, you know, food like restaurants and things are noticing that is, you know, catching on. They're getting a lot more requests for, you know, vegan food. So it is, they may have like a couple of vegan options that they have regularly that they do. But, you know, they taking part in the event with us to expand that and try some new things out. And, you know, yeah, like you said, and, you know, get some more, you know, vegan plant-based customers interested that'll come in and give it a shot.
I mean, I guess that's the chef challenge part, right, is to have them kind of come along in their discovery of ways to present and prepare vegan foods and maybe get them on the menu permanently.
Right, right. That's sort of with the project. That is like one of our main goals, to help them, you know, in doing that. It's a good opportunity for them to like give it a try. And then with the, you know, vegan challenge, to have it promoted and to, you know, get the whole city, you know, to hear about it and to give it a shot. And so that's for the chefs that are taking part. That's like a big part of it.
And we mentioned, you know, things like the carbon footprint, which, you know, has been shown that meat eating definitely contributes to an enormous amount of carbon emission, but we shouldn't minimize, as you say, the condition of animals and the way that they're treated, particularly on large farms. But that's a conversation that's been evolving. It does seem like there's some progress.
Yeah, that's right. More and more people are, you know, finding out about veganism, like it, all different, you know, channels, like groups like ours that do outreach. But, you know, you also have so many new documentaries on the channels like Netflix and Amazon, you know, that have like all kind of things that you can look into to learn about it. And the animal side of it is something that, like, it is, you know, like when people do sort of get that idea and think more about it, is like, you know, a little bit shocking at first because you didn't maybe consider that. Myself, I grew up on a farm, so I did have like an early introduction to that. But it is an issue. I'm really thankful that people are looking at it, because individually it is like a way that we can all sort of reduce what's happening to animals and as part of the industry.
Well, Yuri Mitskovich, thank you so much for being here. Appreciate the description of the Chef Challenge.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for the invite.
And that's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions, and you could send either to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Join us tomorrow when we talk about the civil rights protest in St. Augustine that led to the largest mass arrest of rabbis in American history. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.